Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Jennifer Sheehy Skeffington. She is Assistant Professor of Social Psychology at the London School of Economics and Political Science. She is a social psychologist interested in the mechanisms underlying our human sensitivity to power, status, and group membership, their origins, interactions, and manifestation in societal context. So, Dr. Sheehy Skeffington, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
So, let's start with this question then. Are humans a hierarchical species?
Hierarchical, yes, indeed. I mean, similar to our nearest primate ancestors. And I think some of the most interesting places where you see this is in the developmental social cognition literature, where you can see infants, even before they've had much exposure to culture, before they can even speak, seem to have an understanding of social dominance relations between agents. And especially, that's important because you need to know about hierarchy and your position within a hierarchy in order to be able to survive, to not get into costly fights, and to kind of behave in line with what's expected in wider society. Now, in terms of what's different about human dominance hierarchies compared to animal dominance hierarchies, some thinking there, especially in the cultural evolutionary line, has focused on the difference between dominance and prestige as alternative routes to social status as a broader category. I think there's a lot there, but that what's more interesting than dissociating the two is in thinking about how dominance hierarchies get overlaid with status expectations in humans. The key point is that if you want to The key point, as I would see it, is that if you want to be at the top of a dominance hierarchy, that's a human one, in a, or in a very social cultural species, you need to make sure that you can also have status, i.e., sources of legitimization of your position. So the legitimization of dominance becomes particularly important. It's not just enough to be the bigger, stronger one.
But are hierarchies based on dominance and prestige two different things, or not?
I mean, some theorize that they are, and that once we move over to considering humans compared to other animals, the only hierarchy that matters is a prestige one. Everything is about prestige-based learning and therefore social position. And I think that that's really important. There's such important contributions to be made from that work and looking specifically at how the basic mechanisms of social learning inform the kinds of pathways people take to status for humans. But ultimately, from my perspective, it's about who controls power and resources and who gets to control power and resources. And whether that's legitimated through dominance or legitimated through prestige is less important than who's got what. But I do think it's very psychologically interesting to look at precisely in human societies how that is legitimized and how people come to accept it versus not accept it.
And how does an evolutionary perspective help us better understand power and status in human societies?
Well, from one perspective, I think understanding how important it is and it has been for survival can help recognize the potency of it as a characteristic of the social world. So what that means is that I will be sensitive to power and my psychological processes will respond differently depending on whether I'm in a high or low power position. We see that from a lot of social psychological research, but also that inequalities and distribution of resources, even between groups in wider society, will really matter to us and will affect our well-being, how we see the world, and the ways in which we try to navigate that world. I think that's important. I think an evolutionary perspective is important precisely to introduce that sensitivity to societal conditions, as opposed to negate that, to say that social experiences or wider inequalities that are structural are less important. I actually think it makes them more important because it helps them understand why they affect us the way they do.
Right. And how about group identity? I mean, what is group identity from an evolutionary perspective, and perhaps how does it relate to the other aspects we've been talking about?
Sure. I mean, I think again, the infant cognition literature is really helpful here because another groundbreaking paper there, and this isn't my work, this is the work of others. So far, I've been discussing Lotta Thomson and Liz Spelke's work. and sorry, Lindsay Powell. So what they found is that also infants are ready to perceive who's in different groups, and they will use basic cues such as synchrony to infer a kind of a groupishness. And this really underpins what we know from decades of research from social identity theory, that group identity is core. I think what's interesting and what an evolutionary perspective might add to that is the notion of coalitional psychology, as has been put forward by others, and in particular to argue that there aren't any fundamental lines along which groups need to be delineated or will necessarily, along which group cognition will necessarily always be activated. What's core is to understand along what lines am I cooperating versus competing with different others. And in modern societies, when especially in societies where resources are distributed along particular group lines, such as racial lines or caste lines, then those forms of group identity are going to become the most salient, because they that's the nature of the group-based hierarchy in that society, and that's the lines along which people cooperate and compete. But if we wish to try to build let's say a broader solidarity or a common identity, even in ethnically heterogeneous societies, that should be possible to the extent that we really can create that solidarity across ethnic racial lines. So some kind of superficial common identity isn't going to be enough. Actually affecting the ways in which groups relate to each other, who's got what, and the extent to which we really are interdependent on each other, I think can have a big effect, because that will switch on coalitional psychology, modulate it specific to those kinds of new contexts, which I actually think is quite hopeful. Evolutionary perspectives are often seen as usually quite pessimistic for broader social change or social democratic ideals.
Yeah, so let me see if I get this right. So does that mean then that for us to have a better understanding of how people form their group identities, it's much more useful for us to look into a cooperation and competition than, for example, into certain social categories people might have, like, for example, gender, race, class, or something like that?
Not necessarily, because the reason gender, race, and class are such hot issues and are the means through which a lot of our coalitional psychology is playing out is because they are indicators of stable ways in which power and resources are distributed in society. So power is systematically distributed asymmetrically according to these categories, more and less so in different countries, however. And I think that it's precisely that those levels of inequality that come to light in different countries, which can help us understand the relative salience of those group categorizations. And you can see this even in kind of basic visual cognition studies and even neuroscience studies, that the brain will change the way that it parses the social environment depending on these kinds of dynamics. Mm-hmm. But that so it's not at all to minimize the potency of commonly studied categories. It's just to say that I don't think it's enough to say, because we're tribal beings, therefore we'll always be racist. That I think it's because we are coalitional beings who care about hierarchy that we will pay attention to the cooperative and competitive dynamics along which power and resources are distributed in society, and that will really shape our sense of who's with us and who's against us. It's precisely that malleability that leaves an opening for political action and political ideology, for example, which I could talk about later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that it's important to emphasize that malleability, because there are people on the extreme right, for example, that take advantage of literature on the categories, the social categories people use, like gender, race, class, ethnicity, for example, to make a case that these are fixed categories. And I mean, if people try to create multicultural societies or multi-ethnic societies, then that only brings about conflict and stuff like that, and people can't really do anything about it. So,
no, I think a coalitional psychology perspective would precisely go against that, and I think it's an example of where kind of these kinds of appeals to biological underpinnings don't necessarily needn't necessarily be co-opted by the right in those kinds of ways.
Yeah. So what is social dominance orientation and how does it shape how we see the world?
Sure. So the construct of social dominance orientation becomes relevant when we scale up from our understandings of the social world that are more arising from an interpersonal context in infancy and in childhood, to thinking about ourselves as members of a wider social world. And in societies, any society with economic surplus, which is most these days, we invariably find that resources are distributed according to group-based hierarchy, as some groups have more than others. This is an observation made by social dominance theory, so Jim Sedanius and Felicia Prado. What social dominance orientation is an orientation towards that hierarchy. It's effectively a stable individual difference in the extent to which you think it's okay or right that resources should be distributed asymmetrically along the lines of that hierarchy, that some groups should get more than others. And it's one of the most widely studied individual difference variables in political psychology, precisely because it predicts so much about subsequent political behavior, and also, anything from, it's not just that it predicts things like racism and racist attitudes and sexism and anti-environmentalism, et cetera, it even predicts things like which academic major you're likely to take, how well you'll perform in that major, which jobs you're likely to take, how well you'll do in certain institutions. And our own research has shown it even shapes how you perceive the world. So even basic visual perceptive processes, such as whether you notice cues about inequality in your surrounding environment, or whether you will categorize racially ambiguous targets as a member of your group versus as not a member of your group. It seems that these kind of preferences for the world being a particular way then mediate how we then construe that world in ways that go even below conscious attention.
So that point about how people perceive inequality, so it's more important here how people perceive it than how it actually is. I mean, is it more important how people perceive, for example, economic inequality than the actual levels of economic inequality we have?
No, the research doesn't speak to the relative importance of perceptions over existing inequality. I mean, inequality affects people, or a lot of inequality's effects are mediated through one's construal of it. And I think that whether one notices cues to inequality, but even more strongly, the extent to which there are narratives circulating in society that bring attention to inequality, that highlight inequality along one particular set of group lines versus another, and that justify or argue against it. That's really going to affect how you process it, how you come to understand and give meaning to the inequalities you see around you. There are other aspects of inequality too, such as breakdown in solidarity between the rich and the poor that will actually affect support for welfare policies, that will concretely affect people's life outcomes at the bottom of society. So there are other ways that don't need to be mediated through construal.
Does social dominance orientation have any sort of genetic basis?
Yes, and that was one of the more surprising things that we found. I mean, first of all, as you might guess, how you feel about whether resources should be distributed unequally in society on the basis of groups, one big determinant of that is going to be your own group membership. So your own particular social interest will really matter, as one might expect. Broader societal factors also matter, how many resources there are in the environment. So the poorer a society is, the greater resource conflict there is, usually higher levels of SDO in that society on average there are. Those in higher social groups have higher SDO, but also, it's not just coming from these kind of socialized experiences and exposure to the wider society. It also seems to be reflecting in part these heritable adaptive strategies for navigating hierarchy. And so we've done some twin study research, one of the largest twin studies looking at genetic basis of ideology, uncovering not just a substantial genetic basis for SDO, but also genetic grounding of the correlations between SDO and RWA, authoritarianism, the other key predictive variable in political psychology, and also between SDO and policies. So it seems that it's not just your preference for group inequality, but it's also how you enact those preferences in supporting or opposing particular policies out in the world. They all seem to hang together as a kind of a behavioral syndrome, which is evolutionarily grounded. And what that implies is that it means that it's reflecting some kind of key adaptive strategy, which we think, this is work with Lotta Thompson, is about navigating hierarchy, precisely because of the importance of hierarchy. to survival.
Yeah, so how does this research help us understand the appeal of particular policies and perhaps some political ideologies that are both expressed on the right and the left, like populism?
Well, I think that understanding ideology as this interplay between biological sensitivities and socio-ecological context can be very helpful. It goes beyond hierarchy and thinking about social dominance orientation. I also think it what's relevant here are other forms of social relationship that could obtain that aren't just about whether we have equality or hierarchy. Another is communality, communal sharing, this notion that we're all in it together, which is a relational model, to follow Alan Fiske's theory, governed by resources going to those who need it. And another is proportionality. So it's not necessarily that we should have equality for the sake of equality, but inequality is okay to the extent that it reflects different proportional contributions. People should get from society proportional to what they give to society. And what Lotta and I do is we extrapolate these different relational models, communality, equality, hierarchy, and proportionality, from the interpersonal to the intergroup context, and find that that helps us predict a lot of support for different policies. So one thing we're looking at right now is, for example, your preferences for how vaccines should be distributed, whether they should go to the neediest first, or whether they should go to people, whether they should be available to everyone equally, regardless, randomly, or whether more important groups in society should get access first. These are also driven by these kind of preferences, by whether you think which of these relational forms arising from the interpersonal context should be applied when we consider resource dilemmas at the societal context. So that's general policies. When it comes to populism, this is some other work that that I've done. What we're looking at there is effectively, I think, the importance of going back to what we were saying about malleability of understanding of which groups matter. I think what some populist platforms reflect are also malleability of the understanding of what's the nature of the intergroup hierarchy. And it's that ability to shift people from thinking about, let's say, it's lower social class versus upper social class, to thinking about it's we the people versus they the elites, or it's our country versus anyone from not our country. So what populist rhetoric is trying to do is to shift people from thinking about one intergroup hierarchy to another. So changing their very basic construal about who is their group, what is the hierarchy, is it fair? So it's really pulling on these levers that we've been discussing. And so one thing I'm looking at is doing qualitative discourse analysis of seeing precisely how that's achieved rhetorically, and which tropes and themes succeed and which don't, in order to convince people to switch on their coalitional and their hierarchy psychology in those ways.
Do you have any evolutionary rationale for how these individual differences in certain psychological proclivities that then lead people to embrace certain political ideologies would have arisen?
An evolutionary rationale for why the individual differences would have arisen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, there is, I suppose you're pointing there to a key difference between appealing to evolutionary reasoning for the sake of understanding adaptations, which would be a universal psychology. Why, for example, we are all sensitive to hierarchy, we are all sensitive to groups, to shifting towards understanding individual differences. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, to the extent that hierarchy matters to all of us, why don't we all have the same understanding of hierarchy? Why do they seem to these evolved stable individual differences? And there, I think what's most likely are principle to help there are principles of balancing selection, which is similar to the principles of selection that have been theorized to hold when it comes to personality differences. And that says that what is adaptive in a particular environment depends on the distribution of that trait in that environment. So whether it's good to be extroverted, for example, depends on the distribution of extroverts in the environment. Also, I think whether it's adaptive to, let's say, endorse hierarchy depends on what others around you are thinking. It also, of course, depends on these socio-ecological characteristics that we discussed, who has what, which group you're in, and what the nature of what's the ecological context, what available resources are there. So I think it's likely a balancing selection, and that would lead to predictions that you would find heritability in individual traits. I mean, I think that's interesting to the extent that we can look at the underlying logic, but that doesn't mean that that's where we should stop in terms of understanding ideological individual differences. I think that's the starting point, and then you bring in the societal and the childhood and the wider influences, isn't it? There's no reason that looking at the innate aspect of it means we need to leave out the societal aspect.
Yeah, sure. And how does your work shed light on the dynamic slash persistence of social inequality?
Sure. Well, a lot of these approaches I've been drawing on social dominance theory. That's the primary framework that I apply in my work. And what appealed to me about that theory was that it was a multi-level framework. Right? So it's drawing on, in order to understand the ubiquity of social inequality along the lines of groups across societies with economic surplus, it draws on explanatory processes that exist not only at the individual level, such as social dominance orientation, but also at the group level, thinking about social identity, at the institutional level. So it studies these kind of individual institutional dynamics, who comes into an institution, how do they get socialized, how do people get rewarded for certain kinds of behavior. Jim Sedaney has particularly studied this with the police force and how the police force end up being so brutalizing to particular groups in society, and then also the ideological level. And what's exciting about the ideological level is that that creates an opening for bringing in classic social theory that has talked about ideology, Althusser, Gramsci, for example, this kind of critical stance of understanding narratives about the social world and the role they perform in serving particular social interests. And it connects that to psychology, right, to understandings of basic social cognition that are biologically grounded. And you rarely see that kind of integration of critical social theory with evolutionary psychology. This is why Jim and Felicia made enemies both on the right hand and on the left in pushing forward that theory. But I think that kind of multi-level thinking and open-mindedness, all embedded in this critical spirit, but with this kind of openness to scientific inquiry, I think that's good. That's what's going to be able to help us understand and ultimately combat inequalities.
Okay, so about all of that, let me just ask you this question. So if people have these psychological proclivities, and some of them vary on an individual level, and then they are exposed to certain social conditions and they react to that, they incorporate that information, and then they adopt certain political ideologies, is there any place here for the influence that ideas might have? I mean, because it would seem to me that, okay, so people have these psychological proclivities, they react to their environment, and then that's why they have certain ideas or why they are attracted to certain political ideologies. And I mean, is there any room for these being explained in any way by being exposed to certain ideas, or is that just biological proclivities plus influences from the social environment?
And tell me if I've got your question wrong, but one way of interpreting your question is to say, what is the role of ideas, i.e. is there a role for beliefs, values, and ideas that we get from reading, from literature, from culture, social representations effectively in mediating this? And I think absolutely. So when I say ideology, I don't mean ideology in terms of broad individual differences. I mean ideology in its broadest sense, in an Althusserian sense, in terms of those narratives that we use to interpret the social world, which are of course inflected by power interests. And I think so it's precisely in taking that critical stance to understanding, in particular, what we would call hierarchy enhancing versus hierarchy attenuating effects of particular ideas, that I think one can understand what they're doing. And this is again a contribution of social dominance theory, which says that, you know, if someone's making a statement, let's say admissions should be colorblind, admissions to university should be colorblind, we learn less about what that statement is doing by just examining the content of it itself, as opposed to examining it in the wider context of who's using it in order to achieve what aims. Mm-hmm. And so kind of embedding understandings of the world or stories about how the world is in terms of broader interests. So somebody supportive of affirmative action could say, because admissions should be colorblind, and they haven't been because they have been racialized, For the past century, we therefore need to correct that by using affirmative action. But of course, somebody opposed to affirmative action could use the same statement, admissions should be colorblind, to say, oh, well, therefore we shouldn't pay attention to race anymore in admissions. The question is who's using it, in what ways, in what context. So that kind of denutralizing of the way people describe the world, I think, can be a particularly helpful contribution. The problem with that, of course, is that it means that you become quite cynical, right? So it means that anything that anyone's saying is potentially suspect, because you're just critiquing it in terms of its impact on the wider world. And that can become problematic when it comes to doing science as well, because the validity of any inquiry is now dependent on the impact that it could potentially have, or that people are trying to use it for on wider society or on wider inequalities. But I think there it's important to separate, as Jim does, you know, the truth value of a proposition from its ideological uses. So just as we should always be alert to how these kinds of stories and narratives and statements can be used in ideological ways, and could be and are being used in ideological ways, we also need to see that that's separate to whether or not those statements are true. So I still think it's possible to uncover perhaps uncomfortable truths about, let's say, human nature or the world, and not shy away from that because of its potential ideological application, but at the same time to maintain that critical awareness of its ideological application. So I've kind of veered a little bit into a sociology of science question. I hope, does that address the question about ideas?
Yeah. I mean, I only asked that question because there's sometimes this debate if, so when it comes to politics, when it comes to historical phenomena, for example, what was more important? If it that kind of Marxist perspective, materialistic Marxist perspective, that ideas don't matter that much. What matters and gives rise to different social organizations, political organizations, and so on, are the material conditions people are exposed to. And in this case, we would add some biological influences. Or if it's really the ideas that influence and determine how societies get organized, political systems, and so on. I mean, it was basically that kind of question, because there's a lot of this debate.
Absolutely. And I think a political psychological perspective would absolutely push back on that kind of material determinism, because it's precisely the subjective mediation of one's experience of those conditions that really matters. And also, that's quite hopeful, because it's not just that it gets mediated through people's understandings, and that those understandings are completely the product of the kind of manipulative actions of people controlling the media and controlling the discourse. It's also that there is some agency there. You know, there is consciousness, there is imagination, and there is the possibility to think not just about the current social order, but also about potential alternative social orders. And I think, you know, as Hannah Arendt says, this kind of possibility of newness is the really scary thing for those who maybe would wish to push certain narratives for the means of social control, because there is kind of human agency in stepping back from it and choosing one over another and choosing different actions over other actions at the end of the day.
Yeah. So another question, how does poverty affect people's psychology? I mean, what kind of impact does poverty have on people?
Right. So this is touching on another area of my research where I'm trying to understand the impact of position within society on our psychology, as opposed to thinking about psychology feeding into the kind of societies we get. What is the impact then of being in a particular place in that society on our psychology? And I've tried to look at this by moving beyond a discourse around decision-making in contexts of poverty that is focused on so-called deficient behaviors or deficient values. So poor people aren't working hard enough, they've become dependent on welfare, not valuing education, being biased toward the present, to try to understand decision-making in its socio-ecological context. So what actually is the context of decision-making that people are facing? People are facing scarcity, not having enough resources. People are also facing instability, and that's critical because it means you can't predict resource supply. So you can't reliably project into the future. And they're also facing low social valuation. they're devalued by their wider social context. They're doing worse than others in society, and that is portrayed as a negative thing. They're socially excluded. And some more recent work has started to look at decision-making in context of poverty as a result of the kind of cognitive disruption that can come about, in particular through scarcity. But I think that there's also work that which is more resonant with my own, which says that it's not just about disruption. If we take a socio-ecological lens, we can see how our mind actually quite rationally or adaptively responds to these kinds of ecological conditions. For example, if you don't have enough resources, if you can't predict what's going to happen in the future, if you don't have reliable social partners because of social exclusion, you don't know what will happen in the future. It may not be rational for you to hold off on immediate rewards for the sake of an uncertain future. It may not be possible for you to get beyond your concrete immediate situation to think about abstract goals such as health goals. So trying to think about the kind of basic mechanisms that are affected by these situations, I focus on cognitive processes, cognitive modulation, executive functioning, shown how executive functioning can be damaged by experiences of scarcity, but in other conditions it can be enhanced, and it just depends on how you frame the situation, and it's possible to frame the situation in ways that uncover some of these more resilient responses of cognition. Also in terms of appraisals of control, so whether you think you can control the environment, this is really key, and whether you think your behavior actually matters for your life outcomes. It's not just whether I think I can do things, that's self-efficacy. It's whether me doing things matters for my life at all, response efficacy. So no amount of self-efficacy will help you if you've got low response efficacy, and that's important for thinking about health-related interventions and try to persuade people to believe in themselves more, let's say. And then the third is self-regulation. So I try to think about focusing on the future versus, now versus the future, here versus far away. And more recently, I'm looking at affective regulation too. So when is it that we experience sadness and in particular shame in response to poverty? What are the role of wider social representations and narratives for the shaming of people in poverty? And then how can we understand what we might think is, again, damaging things such as a bias toward the present as actually kind of a form of reaction to a route to emotion regulation in these challenging circumstances? And what is the potential for challenging those societal narratives, those kind of wider neoliberal norms that shame people in poverty, as a way of liberating people from that self-shaming?
Right. And does economic inequality or perceived inequality have the same sort of effects?
I mean, it's not exactly the same, and there is often a lot of conflation of concerns around poverty with concerns around inequality. But where I do think that my work on poverty can inform studies of the psychological impact of inequality is in particular this the social dimension. So the more unequal a society is, the more left out of society will be those at the bottom, and the more intense are social comparison effects. The more intensely do we notice who has what, and that's been found in other research. But of course, I think that's going to depend on exposure. If society is highly segregated, such that people aren't seeing how rich and poor others are, the effects might change. But of course, exposure, not just in your immediate environment, also in television, and also wider norms, whether norms prevail, let's say, how you're doing in society is a product of your hard work or your talent or your effort versus the role of broader structural factors.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting because, for example, I remember reading Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now. I think that's the book where he mentions that literature when he was talking about happiness reports across the world. And I mean, he basically concluded that economic inequality wasn't as important as people having access to certain basic needs and also perhaps some pluses, like, for example, being able to travel and stuff like that. But I mean, really, just by virtue of social comparison, economic inequality itself, even if people at the bottom are not really living in dire poverty, can be an issue.
I mean, I've debated with Steve a lot about this. I do think that I do agree that, of course, meeting basic needs is going to be more important. But you know, in line with a more critical lens, one needs to be careful about ideological efforts to shift energies that are concerned about inequality towards it just being about poverty alleviation. But I also think that there's perhaps too quick a readiness on the left to jump on any findings that say that inequality is bad. For example, the work of Wilkinson and Pickett was quite uncritically accepted, where those, you know, despite the fact that those kinds of cross-national comparisons of the impact of inequality aren't done with sufficient controls to be able to be sure about the mechanism and aren't accompanied always by longitudinal analyses that show the same country at periods of inequality versus less inequality has an impact, although there are those studies too. And those studies do show impacts on anxiety, depression, and also on social cohesion and so and political participation. But I think the question of whether it matters how rich very rich people get, we're really trying to get an understanding of that now by thinking about probably the most worrying aspects of that are impacts on social solidarity. So whether if society gets so divided that a collective we isn't possible anymore, such that there isn't enough support for a strong welfare state, that starts to get problematic. Or if people are so wealthy that they can just opt out of participation in broader society. I think that's where some of the more pernicious effects can play about, come about.
And perhaps down the line that could have really a real impact on how people at the bottom live, right? I mean, it could get worse.
Yeah, absolutely, because people at the bottom aren't categorized as in the same we anymore as a majority of society, or even if they are as a majority of society, the super rich minority don't see themselves as part of that majority society. They see themselves as some kind of international elite, and so they're no longer concerned with the well-being of those at the middle or the bottom, and that's just going to erode the tax base. It's going to erode the ability to be able to develop that kind of strong welfare state, social democracy that kind of presumes that kind of collective identity. Mm-hmm. So I think it's slightly more complicated than some of the more simplistic interpretations would say, but it's still there.
Yeah. Did we see any of these effects after the 2008 economic crisis?
I think some of the interesting aspects about what happened there was that it was the first time that people started thinking about society in that way, that a construal of intergroup hierarchy started falling along the lines of thinking about wealth, extreme wealth. So the Occupy movement, 99% and 1%, that was a genuine psychological shift in the way people are thinking about things. That introduced a new intergroup hierarchy that I think the success of which can't be judged along the lines of whether the Occupy movement was successful, because of course the Occupy movement was more process-based and was about that psychological shift. But the fact that concern about economic inequality and especially comparisons between the 99th or 90th percentile and the 50th, the fact that they were mainstreamed in political discourse, both in the US and the UK, for example, does speak to some kind of successful ideological usage of that economic crash. And perhaps, for the sake of combating inequality, perhaps it also destigmatized poverty somewhat to the extent that, you know, as with the pandemic, that middle-class people found themselves suddenly without an income and suddenly living on the edge.
Yeah. And do you think that we could see something like that after the pandemic because of the economic effects it's having?
Well, certainly, again, to the extent that people can take the perspective of poor people more because they know what it's like to experience instability. I mean, this is one thing we're looking at where we've done, this is with my PhD student, Ivan Cano Gomez. We've looked at exposing people to primes that remind them of the personal instability brought about by the pandemic. We look, what's the impact of that on your sense of agency? And how does that change across the socioeconomic spectrum? It turns out those low in SES, they just have low agency no matter what. But those mid and high in SES, when they think about that instability, their agency goes down. And there might be an opening there to use a perspective-taking manipulation, whereby thinking about the instability of the pandemic could increase solidarity for those who for whom instability and lack of control is just an everyday story of their lives. I also think this notion of whether and which relational model applies to society at large, whether it's communality, solidarity, which would be triggered by interdependence, there might be potential there through this, at least notions of interdependence that we've all been talking about and experienced in the pandemic, to kind of underpin perhaps openness to more radically redistributive or solidaric social policies.
Right. So one last question, since we've been talking about things from evolutionary psychology on the one hand and social psychology on the other, and you're trying to integrate things a little bit here, how do you go about doing that? Because sometimes, I mean, the more evolutionary biological aspects, at least at first sight, would seem to be at odds with the literature coming from social psychology, which tends to focus mostly on, social aspects, social influences, the environment, and aspects like that.
Probably, I might end up repeating myself a bit here, but maybe that's not such a bad thing. But the first thing to say is probably that I just find it very unhelpful to have a knee-jerk reaction against anything evolutionary or biological. And that's something I've experienced a lot as a social psychologist. It's certainly not a popular thing. And I think where that knee-jerk reaction comes from is an association between certain kinds of ways of doing science and certain ideological uses of science. That are politically repulsive to most social psychologists. They would also be politically repulsive to me. And what I was trying to argue earlier was to say that we can decouple them. We can be open to looking at biological underpinnings of hierarchy or of inequality preferences without at the same time, while at the same time, or even the impact of poverty on decision-making, while at the same time maintaining that critical stance to say, well, hang on a second, how might discourse about poverty and decision-making be used to individualize the issue of poverty? How might discourse around the innate understandings of hierarchy be used as a way of saying, well, we'll always have inequality, so there's nothing we can do about it, it's biologically grounded. One can maintain that critical stance while still being willing to study it, because I think if you do study it, then you can help get understand things that I don't think have been well addressed by a purely social constructionist or environmental influence-based form of psychology, such as the persistence of inequality, why we seem to backslide so quickly back into quite extreme forms of racism, violence, domination, contra Steve Pinker's approach, where history seems to perhaps be more circular than always this narrative of progress. And also the potential for more utopian social projects to be grounded on a realistic understanding of human nature, and the potential to take advantage of the empathic aspect of human nature, of communality and solidarity and what brings people together, what we learn from the evolution of cooperation, for example, and culture, to be able to build better societies too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and perhaps, if you have certain political goals in mind, of course, you don't need to have them to do science. But if you have, then I think it's better for you to understand how people's psychology really work, even down to their biological underpinnings, to really predict how people will behave in these or that ecological conditions, than simply assuming that all is socially constructed and then not being able to have any sort of predictive ability.
Yeah, it would seem a real shame if, doing science for a social project, and we're all doing, there is no science that's apolitical, but if even, social justice-oriented science insisted on being completely blind to certain questions for the sake of that guilt by association, because it seems to sound like what people in an opposing political coalition are doing. So we have to watch out for the impact of our own coalitional psychology, of our own kind of ideological stances in preventing us from asking certain questions. I think we should be able to ask the questions, we should be able to have the debates, but that doesn't mean that we need to be naive about how they can be used. So this constant vigilance about the uses of science and the political uses of science, I think, needs to be maintained alongside that.
Yeah. Okay, so before we go, where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. I mean, I have my LSE profile that links to my website. I try to keep that updated with publications. I'm also on Twitter, though I'm not as active as I should be, but you can also find me there.
Okay, great. So I will be leaving links to that in the description box of the interview. And Dr. Sheehy Skeffington, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. Please consider supporting the show. It's thanks to people like you that it keeps running. I will leave links for Patreon and PayPal in the description box. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlight's Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett, Perga Larsen, Lagurero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf, Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingart, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, then Demetri, Robert Windegar, Rui Inácio, Arthur Kozup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Sandra Colombo, Jorge Pinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Evan Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librant, Oslin Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Weira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Desaraujo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Please, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidi, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Brunner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litzke, my producers, Izar Webb, James Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Vanagdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardus France, and Thomas Trumbull, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieschi, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Labender, and Sergio Codriano. Thank you for all.